welcome to another episode of PhD Pending, the podcast for early career humanities scholars. My name is Anne Mahler and I have a PhD in English literature. Together, we will deep dive into different aspects of PhD life and explore what it really means to do a PhD in the humanities. My guest today is Dr. Samantha Morse. Sam specializes in the long 19th century British literature with an emphasis on the Gothic and effect theory. She finished her PhD in 2020, an unfortunate COVID grad who didn't get a hooding ceremony, just like myself. She accepted an English faculty position at an elite college preparatory school in Miami, Florida, where she taught British literature and science fiction for a year before deciding to leave the conventional academic system and start her own business. Now, she travels the US in a Ford Transit van that she built with her husband and teaches and mentors high schoolers, college students, and grad students remotely. She's also a book coach for full professors and early career scholars. Sam, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to connect.
I know. And let's tell people a small bit about how we met, because we had Luciana on the show already in episode 2 of season 4, and she taught us everything about the American PhD system. And actually, the same day that I met Luciana is how we met, because we all ended up in the same apartment together for the International Gothic Association Conference in 2019.
That's right, in Romeoville, of all places, Illinois. the fine, right, it was Romeoville. It's outside of Chicago.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah, when they told us it's gonna be just outside Chicago, and just outside Chicago meant 2.5 hours drive outside of Chicago.
I was also taken for a loop by that, but it was amazing. We all got to connect and geek out about our Gothic love and dance at the Gothic disco. That was a big highlight for me.
I know, honestly, that was, I think, one of the best nights of my entire PhD.
Right.
That was a great night.
It was absolutely amazing. No, that was so much fun.
And I also remember that you were the super active one who ran half marathons before the conference.
Well,
so do you want to tell us more about that? Because you're not just like published in like all these amazing journals, which we're going to talk about in a second, but you're also running those like marathons and you're doing triathlons and Ironmans, and it's just wild.
Well, for that, actually, Romeoville was a great place because there was this like nature preserve right by the university, so I would just go for my morning runs. It was so lovely. But you know, triathlon actually kept me sane during grad school. It was really, and marathons too, were a really important part of my mental health. I signed up for my first marathon, this is a funny story, when I was applying to grad school. Because, and I had never done any running race before, mind you. Like, I was not really a runner.
Yeah.
But I was so nervous about applying to grad school and certain I wasn't going to get in. And I was like, oh, all of these committees can say I can't come to their grad school, but nobody can tell me I can't do a marathon. And so it, like, became this, like, really, like, mentally empowering thing where, like, even if I was really tired, I'm like, okay, I can mentally convince myself to keep running, and like nobody can stop me from doing that. And so I did my first marathon in January of 2014. And in February, I got accepted to UCLA. So it just was this like beautifully symbolic thing to me of like, your hard work can pay off.
It just all fell into place, kind of. And also a bit of a mental health saver, right?
Totally, yeah. I mean, I like, for me, I really found that for as much as I use my brain, like, I need to use my body in equal ways. Like, if I'm going to be really pushing myself intellectually to be reading difficult things and to be writing, it just feels very therapeutic to also be, like, physically moving a lot, too. So that was just really helpful. And also for structuring your day. Like, if you wake up, you go for a run, you already feel, like, ready to go. It's a lot easier to sit down at your computer and write, or to like sit and read for hours.
That's true. Yeah. And speaking of grad school and speaking of, you know, your research process, one of the main things that I remember from you is that you casually walked up in your panel and you presented your conference paper and you were like, oh yeah, and I got published in Studies in the Novel. And for people who don't know, that's one of the biggest high impact, high profile journals that you can get in English literature. So we were all really struck by this. And now you're even published in like even more journals. Do you want to tell us your publication history a small bit? Like what kind of journals have you gotten published in? And that we get into a bit more particular details.
Yeah, so Studies in the Novel was my first publication, which was like so exciting. It was a big deal, and we can talk more about how I got into that one. But for those people who don't know, Studies in the Novel, it's more of a historicist journal, so they really care about that historical perspective, which aligned with my own research methods. So when we kind of dig deeper in, like I'll say finding fit is really important for the journal. But after Studies in the Novel, I ended up getting published in the Journal of Victorian Culture, which is also a high impact journal, though I first applied to Victorian Studies, which is a slight tier above it, but it wasn't a right fit for my approach. So JVC was amazing. I really loved working with them. Probably the most positive experience I had working with the journal was with JVC. And then after that, I got published in Cultural Critique, though I think the acceptance for Cultural Critique came before JVC, but they had they're really, really slow on their publication, so it took like 2 years for that one to actually get published. But Cultural Critique is a big one that kind of has more of, well, I guess it's all in the title, right? Cultural Critique. So Cultural Studies is kind of their big focus, and so it doesn't necessarily matter what material you're working with as long as it fits within that framework.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, okay, so let's take us back to the start, right? So obviously you went to UCLA, which is a high profile school, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about the publication requirements of UCLA, of your department.
Yeah, well, I mean, you may have gone over this with Luciana, and I don't know what other schools are like, but at UCLA, at least, there were no publication requirements. I think the American system puts less emphasis on publication requirements than the British or European school system, at least as far as I know. So for us, there was never any pressure where, okay, you need to publish by this point in the program, even though from, you know, the first or second year of grad school, they always were telling us, like, you want to be published. Like, that was obviously, like, a goal, but it wasn't a requirement. So our professors in seminars would often tell us, okay, like, think about your seminar as, like, a first draft for something that you would submit for publication. But honestly, like, in my first year of grad school, I was still just struggling to, like, write the seminar papers, and I wasn't even fathoming that they would become published articles. But in my second year, you know, I started to get more of a handle on things, and this article that I got published in Studies in the Novel came out of a seminar that was just a Victorian literature seminar. And the idea that I had for this paper was actually an idea that I had had in undergrad. It was something I had noticed in the short story we had read in my undergrad class, and there was just something about it. There was this like feminist critique that hatched in my brain, and I was infuriated that nobody was focusing on this like poor female character who had her brain operated on in this like really terrible way by this male scientist. And I was obsessed with it in undergrad, and I had written my own short stories about it. Like, it really creatively inspired me back then. And so in grad school, our professor had kind of opened the door for us to write about anything we wanted that was in the Victorian period. So I was like, here's my chance. I'm going to write my big scholarly article exposing the injustice of this like young woman being operated on. And so, you know, kind of fueled by this idealism and passion for the text, I wrote this article, which or paper at that time, which was terrible. It was terrible. You know, it had some great close readings, as they do, but it lacked structure primarily. But fortunately, the professor whose seminar I was in, Jonathan Grossman, bless his heart, like, he is a genius mastermind when it comes to like structure and organization. So, you know, I went into his office hours, and he had this giant whiteboard. After he had read through my paper, he was like, all right, we need to go to the whiteboard. And he proceeded to draw these boxes and these connecting ideas. And like over the course of an hour, he really taught me how to organize a proper paper into an article. And that just blew my mind. Like, that was something I hadn't really understood before. Like, I always kind of prided myself, probably like most grad students, on noticing interesting things in the text, writing good analyses. But it was like I was painting these beautiful pictures and then I was putting them in dollar store frames, right? And I needed to get like the big gold beautiful thing to put in the museum. And Jonathan really taught me how to do that. So through that workshop, like I had a properly structured paper, and it really tightened my argument up when I could see the different components of the argument working together. So that was step one. So yay, I got an A on the seminar paper, but I still didn't submit it to anything. Then the next semester, or I guess UCLA is on quarter. So the next quarter, I was in another Victorian seminar, and this one was with Joe Bristow, who would ultimately become a key person on my dissertation committee. And again, at the end of the seminar, he said, you know, you guys can work on anything you want, even if it's an old paper. I want you to get something ready for publication. So then I started working with Joe on this paper. And if Jonathan's superpower is that like frame and organization, Joe is just a brilliant historicist. And he taught me how to do proper historical research. Like, I was able to get into Gale News Vault and British Periodicals database. And once I was able to really bring in that historical data and actually look at like the history of doctors and these different historical debates about human experimentation, that was what transformed my grad paper into an article. That was real scholarship. So Joe kind of taught me how to be a scholar. And then, bless his heart, he sat with me for innumerable hours and read the paper out loud, making inline corrections to my grammar, to my word choice, to my style, like teaching me how to write. And it was the greatest gift of all. Like, I, you know, as a, you know, anyone who gets their PhD in English is a good writer, but
yeah,
no one's ever sat down and held your hand and told you how to be a great writer. And not that I think I'm a great writer now, but I'm a heck of a lot better than I was when I first started, because he really took the time to do that. So kind of between these two mentors, like, I finally had a paper that, you know, that they had encouraged me to submit to studies in the novel. And UCLA had a pretty good track record of getting grad students published in studies in the novel, not because we have any relationship with them, but like, we're a strong historicist department. Studies in the novel is a historicist journal primarily. So one thing that I had been warned against was that studies in the novel does prefer to not have single author texts. Like, they prefer to have multiple, you know, sources of literature. Yeah. And so I was only looking at one story, but I did bring in a ton of other historical evidence. So I was hoping that would kind of be enough to capture their attention.
Yeah.
And so it was, and so I sent it, and then I got a revise and resubmit, and we can totally talk about that process if you'd like.
Oh yeah. That comes next. It's interesting that you say that you didn't really feel the pressure to publish, because one of the things that Luciana actually told me, their slogan is publish or perish.
Oh my God.
So that seems like a bit of a different philosophy almost. So it's quite interesting to see, like, even it's within the same system, right? But there's different kind of influences, I'd say, right? And it's different kind of philosophies thinking about publications. And so that's really interesting, because she really felt the pressure. And then hearing that kind of laissez-faire kind of you can if you want to or philosophy in UCLA, it's really interesting. And also, I have so many thoughts on just people, the staff sitting down with you and taking so much time to revise your paper. Sounds like such a gift. Like, this is a like off-track question, but is there anything in terms of like structure, like the main thing that you learned that would be valuable for everyone to know, maybe even for me to know, to be honest?
I mean, so I've actually done the whiteboard thing that Jonathan did with me for my students when I was actually teaching in Miami. Like, I got the giant whiteboard and did the thing, and really, like, I really think it's a visual thing. I think, you know, I've done kind of like outlines and stuff before, but actually drawing boxes of the different topics and then arrows that have like what connects that box to the next box and making sure that all of the information that you are including in your article fits into one of those boxes very clearly. And if one is dipping between two boxes, understand why that is and really flag that to the reader. Like, I think Jonathan taught me how to signpost, you know, and I had heard that term signposting before and I had kind of done it a little haphazardly, like, oh, let's do this. But now I, from those boxes, I understood, okay, you can't have it both ways. This needs to fit in one category or the other. And if it's in both, explain why. So that was just amazingly helpful.
I think that's great advice. And I kept telling my students, you need to signpost. I used to tell them, like my second year students and even my first year English students, I would sit them down when we had essay writing classes and I would say to them, it's like, you're putting your reader on a roller coaster if you don't signpost and they don't know where they're going. The way you need to do it is to like take them by the hand and slowly walk them through your ideas and like really point out, you know, what am I doing? Why am I not doing the other thing? And that's just going to pay off at the end, because even when we are reading papers or when I read papers, that's the thing I like about good articles most. When they tell me what's coming and what they just did and, you know, summarizing and really like explaining their choices. So I can really get behind that. I love a good signpost.
Well, and it's interesting too, because through this process, I realized the difference, the different modes of writing between the creative first draft and then the analytical revisions. Like I'm a big fan of being like moved by the text and having that burst of insight and then just like writing in a fury. And I think that that makes for amazing ideas and very fruitful, but and I had always thought that was good enough because in undergrad that always was good enough. And then, you know, this process of signposting, you can only signpost when you do know where you're going and there's a purpose to everything you're doing. And so then I learned, okay, from your like creative genesis, how do you then make this, you know, analytical, reasonable, logical? And so it's this like really cool dance between the like flashes of insight and then the like rigid structure.
In terms of who's read your paper before submission, was it just these two, Joe and Jonathan?
Yeah, it was just, I believe, just Joe and Jonathan for this particular one. But for like subsequent papers that I did, I would have advisors read it. And I was also in 19th century working group. So I'd have it workshopped by the working group. And then others I had had, you know, once I got further along in the program, you know, I kind of had informal partnerships with other grad students and we read each other's work a lot. So later on, I feel like once we had all developed our skills from working with our mentors, we were better able to help each other. I think for that first one, though, I needed professional help.
Don't we all need professional help?
Exactly.
We are in grad school after all.
Exactly.
We talked about the publication requirements in your school. We talked about how you prepared the script and who's read it. Anything you paid special attention to before submitting? So any special requirements? Did you pay attention to the timeline? Because obviously in the humanities, the publication timeline can be quite long, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great question. And so one thing about my program was I was in an MA PhD program, so, and I had funding for 7 years.
Oh, lucky.
So I
Jesus.
Knew, like I knew
so lucky.
I know it was very lucky. Yeah, UCLA is extraordinarily generous, takes really great care of their students, so I had the luxury of time, and I was submitting in my second year of grad school. And so because in our program, the kind of message I got was when you go on the job market, you want to have, ideally, you should have one thing published and one thing kind of under review was the message that I got. So I'm like, I'm in my second year. Studies in the novel can take their sweet time. You know, as long as I get this published eventually, that would be great. So I fortunately, I did not feel the time crunch.
5 years later,
Right. Well, cultural critique basically took 3 years, so.
Like, I do fully understand the peer review process, right? And I also understand that a lot of academics do that on top of their actual work. But the turnaround of 3 years, like, that's just a bit mental.
From when it was fully accepted, I'm not including the peer review, it was over a year from when it was fully accepted until when it was published. It was bizarre.
That is bizarre.
But I'm grateful. Love you, cultural critique.
Yeah, so you kind of paid attention to that in terms of like timeline.
Yeah, and in terms of just other things, this is a funny thing, probably a minor thing to pay attention to, but one of my many flaws is my complete and utter lack of attention to detail when it comes to citations and formatting. And it's just the bane of my existence. I know it's the bane of many people's, but I just don't learn. Like, I'm not good at, like, seeing, I'm like, oh, this one's Turabi and this one has their own magical style. So I did stress about that quite a bit, though, for studies in the novel, because I didn't want, like, missing the formatting to be the thing that made them reject my article or made them not read the article because it was an egregious, failure in their style guide. So I did pay a lot of attention to making sure things were cited properly and it fit the formatting guides of the paper.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I remember when I co-authored an article that then was accepted to a second journal that we applied to that we talked about in a previous season. So go back to season 4 to listen to that journey. I was responsible for doing all the citations and for doing the referencing and for doing the formatting. And like, don't get me wrong, putting another font on, I'm all here for it. But I was used to MLA. I could push it to MHI if I wanted to, but they wanted Chicago. And any kind of foot or end notes, and then they're being so specific in their instructions. And it's like, oh yeah, we're using Chicago, but do it in EndNotes or whatever. And it's for something like that, I find it extremely hard to relearn a different system, especially when so much kind of hinges on it, because it's that first impression, right? That's what that your article is gonna leave. And we've all marked that one student paper that was in Calibri font size 10 single space, right? So
oh my god, I have like flashbacks.
We've all been there. So we don't want to be that person.
100%.
100%, yeah. So that's a really good point. And I think that's something that we keep stressing, you know, if you're applying for something, don't trip over these technicalities. It's just one of these things. So you submit it, you got accepted. Tell us about the peer review process.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So they gave me, it was very specific. It was a revise and resubmit. So it actually wasn't an acceptance, but right, it was a revise it and we'll consider. And so that, like, but I was excited. I wasn't too stressed about that because I was like, great. Like, that's way better than I thought. This is awesome. And then I read the comments, and now that I've had other articles published, I can reflect on those comments and see that they were probably a little unusually cruel. In fact, I would use the word excruciating. Some of the comments actually felt personal. And so I was so shocked by these comments that I couldn't even deal with it. It was, I think, toward the end of a quarter too, and I had other term papers. So I just put it away. I had time. They gave me a decent amount of time to revise. So I was like, you know what? I just need to put this in a drawer for a couple of weeks and forget that this happened. Just kind of let the sting go away, because there were some harsh comments. And then fortunately, I went back to Joe Bristow with the comments and had him read them. And we kind of worked through them together, had like a little bit of a therapy session as well. And he was really helpful in teaching me that you don't have to agree with every single comment. Like, you need to read them all, take them all to heart, But we were to kind of together able to sort through which comments were helpful and which ones were warranted and which ones were not. I don't know if this is true, but we got the sense that maybe one of the peer reviewers was annoyed that I had not cited their article on Arthur Macken, the author of the story I had read, because they had made a comment like, this person doesn't seem to have read any of other Macken's works. And then they cited a bunch of like very obscure stories. And you're like, okay, like that feels a little, you've written this like one, you've written a great article on these obscure stories and you're annoyed that I didn't get it brought in. And so.
It sounds like a bit of a personal agenda that's going on.
Totally.
There, yeah.
So that one felt personal. And, but you know, to the point of you need to see if the comments are warranted. I actually did go and read a ton of other Macken fiction to see if it was worth bringing in those obscure things. And it was not.
Yeah.
But it was really helpful for me to then kind of go back when I submitted to be like, you know what? I do know those things, so back off. And interestingly, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, Studies in the Novel also asked me when I resubmitted to write like a one-page letter explaining my revisions and like responding to the comments from the peer reviewers.
And your choices, yeah.
Exactly. And that was such a gift. That did not happen with my other two, but I think I didn't get revise and resubmits. They gave me kind of minor things. They're like, to fix this, but they had been accepted. So this one, because it was a revise and resubmit, they gave me that opportunity. And that I was really happy with because I did give all the feedback such thoughtful care.
Yeah.
And then there were other things, you know, about clarifying the argument or suggestions for things to add that were very helpful. So I do, in the end, feel like those comments made the article better, but the delivery on some of them was really, really cold. And you know what? Maybe the person wasn't intending that. Like you said, a lot of these people are teaching and doing their own research, and they did it at 1 a.m. with a cup of coffee and their cat just peed on them or something. I don't know. There were other things going on in their life, but it was harsh.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's just one of these things where, especially when it's one of your first submissions, right, and you get this harsh feedback, what does that do to you as a PhD student, right? And this is like putting yourself out there. It's almost like you're starting to date someone, right? And you put yourself out there and then, you know, you get this like harsh, not even rejection, but these like harsh comments, and it's like you really take this to heart. So there's like a lot of like mental work involved as well, because it just feeds the imposter syndrome, right? That definitely happened to me before, that I just fed my imposter syndrome, and the hump then to get over was so much bigger to like submit something else or even just talk to my supervisor about it. You know, it can be quite difficult, especially when you're still in that very vulnerable first stage of your PhD.
Absolutely. No, and I'm so like, I just can't even emphasize this enough, how lucky I was to be at that time working with Joe, because as a supervisor, like he just had infinite wells of compassion, a very prestigious scholar himself, and was able to take away a lot of that imposter syndrome. Like he was the one who actually identified the comment. He's like, this one is personal. And then he did some research to try to figure out why that person maybe wrote the comment. You know, just to have somebody like that in your corner, and whether that's your supervisor or another grad student, like someone who you respect, who's like, actually, like that was a little too harsh. Like, it's just, I think, so helpful, because when we are grad students, I think we're also self-deprecating. Like that's
all the time,
kind of part of the personality, I guess. Like since we're so self-deprecating, it's helpful to just have somebody else who's like, you can beat yourself up, but this person should not be beating you up for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, yeah, it's one of these parts of like PhD culture that I'm not really sure about, the self-deprecation. Like, I have thoughts on that, but because like the academia, the system puts us down enough as is, we might as well wave our own flag, for fuck's sake.
Right.
Like,
right. I never, absolutely.
I personally never understood that, but I also live in the country of self-deprecation. The Irish are great at self-deprecation. So that's something I'm still learning. That's still a culture shock for me. So I'm getting over that. And that's just a very personal struggle on my end, I suppose.
No, I think that's so fair. And, you know, I think that was, to your point, one of the reasons why I did choose to leave academia in the end. Like, I didn't want to be in this exploited system of, like,
yeah,
you just keep getting pushed down. But that's a different topic.
I know, yeah. And we'll get back to that in another episode for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, so maybe to, like, slowly come towards the end, right? So you went through that peer review process and then you resubmitted and then it got accepted.
Yeah, it was accepted. Like, for all of the agony that I put into those revisions and, like, writing this, like, meticulously crafted letter about my revisions,
yeah,
it was like an almost instant acceptance. They were like, yep, looks amazing. And here I was like, oh, really? For how harsh the first comments were, the acceptance was like, ta-da! So that was amazing, and they were super timely in working with the editors just to kind of, again, do the formatting for publication and all that.
Yeah.
It was a super easy process. Studies in the Novel is extremely, extremely organized. Their timeline is quite fast, so it was published very quickly.
Right.
And that was a completely, like, painless process.
That sounds great, yeah. And did this publication or the other, you know, a quote-unquote high-impact publications affect your PhD route at all?
Absolutely. I mean, after getting that one published, and, you know, I felt really great about myself. I got it was accepted in my second year of grad school while I was still in the MA program. So right. I wasn't even ABD or anything. So that gave me a ton of confidence, like, oh, right, like, I can submit to things. And honestly, it wasn't just the acceptance of the publication, but the whole process working with my supervisors and doing the research. Like, I felt like I had just, like, cracked the secret code. I was like, oh, yeah, I can do that again. Like, there was just a model. And it really demystified the article writing process for me. It wasn't just this, like, magical thing that really smart people did. I was like, no, there are certain steps. This is what you have to do. These are the parts that are hard. These are the parts that are fun. Like, it became mechanical. And I mean that in a good way.
Yeah.
Like, and so that was amazing. And I just really applied that exact same process to working on the next article, which I submitted to the Journal of Victorian Culture, after a swift rejection from Victorian Studies. And they were basically just like, and it was great. And that swift rejection did not have the sting of my comments from the previous article. It was just a, this doesn't fit, it's not what we're looking for, thank you.
Fair.
And you're like, all right, fair enough. It, like, to go back to the dating metaphor, it's like somebody shows up and it's just not the personality you want or not the looks that you want, whatever. And you're like, sorry, you seem nice, but look for somebody else.
You're not it.
Yeah. And I appreciated that.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah. So it really, I felt like I cracked the code, and that was why I was able to get, you know, a total of 3 articles published during grad school, which in my program was a lot.
Yeah.
And it also really shaped my PhD in that, like, I was applying for professorships. Like, I wanted that tenure track teaching job, that yeah, unicorn job. And in my program, they really focused on quality over quantity of your research. So they always said, if you have one article published in a high impact journal and then one under review, like, that should be good enough for the job market.
Yeah.
And I was on the job market with 3 published articles in high impact journals. So I was like, great. Like, I feel really, like, qualified and prepared to be on this job market. And of course, like, COVID kind of changed all of that, but it really helped me psychologically too, when I ended up not getting the professorship that I dreamed of when I ended up going to go teach out of high school, because I knew it wasn't for lack of trying and it wasn't for lack of skill. Like I kind of felt like I had gotten these pats on the back, this, like, validation of, you're a good scholar. This is just a terrible market and a really difficult time in history.
Yeah.
And that was very soothing to me.
Yeah, potentially the worst time to go on the job market. Like, I think we were both in that time bracket where it was literally like the worst time to go, not just onto the academic job market, but on any kind of job market, I think. It's like bang on in the middle of COVID. It's not just that, you know, I had a virtual viva, both of us had virtual conferrings or no conferrings at all. And it's just like, it kept snowballing into something bigger. And it's that impact is very much felt for sure. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Towards the end, I always ask my guests two questions. The first one usually is, what are your top three tips or something like that? But today I'm going to ask you, so what's the code then? Tell us the secret code. Break it down into a couple of steps that people can take.
Amazing. Okay. So
if you want to share, of course.
Oh, no. I would love everybody to have the secret code. And I know one of the things that you asked too is like, what would you go back and tell your first yourself? Yeah. And this goes to my code. There's no magic. Like, it's a job and it's a process just like anything else. There's nothing mystical about it. And so this is the secret. And step one is writing a shitty first draft. And I'm stealing that term from the author Anne Lamott in her book on writing Bird by Bird, which I'm reading right now and I love. But it's something I intuitively grasped. And it's like I was saying, like, get your shitty first draft out. That's like creative. It has your awesome close readings. It's what you're excited about. Like, just get your shitty first draft out. And then step number two is to reverse outline. So I do, like, after your thing is written, make a reverse outline and then visually align everything to make sure that you have certain components of your argument that are all locking together. Then personally, for me, only step three do I move into like that deeper, richer connection to scholarship. I'm somebody who gets really swept away when I read other scholars' works. I think that can happen to a lot of grad students. So only after I've really solidified what I want to say do I then go out and do more research on either theoretical stuff or historical stuff. Take a bunch of notes on that, and that usually takes me a very long time. And then I reread my work and I'm like, oh, okay, I was thinking about this. That connects to these ideas. And then I bring in scholarship and I kind of beef it up. So if my article is a person, in steps one and two, it's like this very like emaciated, very lean person. And then after step three, it's kind of this like voluptuous, sexy person, I would like to say, like beefed up by the scholarship. And then step four would be like combing through it super meticulously with attention to grammar, style. And I think I learned the importance of that really through reading out loud with Joe. So I always read my work out loud, very, very slowly. And I did realize there's a colossal difference between good writing and great writing. Mm-hmm. I'm still striving for the great writing, but it's just like with people, like if an attractive person, you know, science data shows this, like an attractive person gets more interviews, you know? So if you like look well put together and you look good for your interview, it's going to help you. And I think the same is with writing. So I do, you know, the final step is like this very close cosmetic attention, to the writing process and knowing where my flaws are too. Like I used to have a tendency toward passive voice or kind of longer sentences. So just know where your little quirks are, and once you know them, they're pretty easy to fix. So yeah, that's my magical process.
The quirks, like, I just got a massive flash of PTSD because at the end of my viva, my extern actually went, so let's talk about the dangling participles in your work. And I was like,
yes, I have gotten that too.
All right, let's can you explain to me what a dangling participle is? I'm like, no. So yeah, I get the necessity for that, but also we all have our quirks, as you said, right? And like our writing styles. And yeah, I mean, what can I say? What can I say? I'm still traumatized from the dangling participles, I'm not gonna lie to you. So definitely an important step, yeah.
What is so funny is that I got that too in undergrad. Literally, it was, I just got my term paper returned to me, and in big red, like, print across the front page was dangling participles ? And it didn't even, like, point to where they were. And I was absolutely baffled, and I was like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
And so, and I remember Googling it, and it still wasn't totally clear to me, but I was too embarrassed to go to the professor and be like, excuse me, this is clearly a problem, but could you explain it?
And it's not even that big of a deal. It's just a stylistic quirk, more or less. So it doesn't really do anything to the actual sentence necessarily. It's just, like, I couldn't explain the dangling participle. Now, to be honest, I completely, like, I corrected everything and then I forgot about it. I'm a non-native speaker. You know, sure. Why the fuck not? You know, like, sure, that's cool. But let's get back to some dangling participles, people. So, definitely, yeah, that was definitely a thing. But, yeah, that's a great breakdown of the process. And you kind of touched on it already, but is there anything else that you would tell your first year PhD self other than it's not magic?
You know, I was thinking about that too, and I was decent about understanding this my first year, but like, if I could just materialize and reaffirm this to my first year self, it would be to enjoy the reading time. Like, when you are preparing for your comps, like, in my program, it was a funded program, so I was literally getting paid to read and write and study and research. Yes. Like, it was amazing, and I knew at the time it was a gift. So many people had told me it was a gift, and I knew that, but I still, and I'm sure this can relate, a lot of people can relate to this, whether or not they're funded. I really had to fight the feeling that reading was self-indulgent. Like, the fact that my job was to read felt very self-indulgent to me when I saw other people who were, like, tromping off to go do things that they hated, or, like, math or things that were difficult. I was like, even if I'm reading something I don't love, like Chaucer, that's still, like, a million times better than anything else I could imagine doing.
Physics.
So
then doing physics, for example.
Then doing physics, right? Or doing something boring, like laying bricks, or, you know, anything. Like, it was a gift. And I think maybe I would tell my first year self, like, you're not being self-indulgent. Like, this is your calling, and the universe or whatever has made it so that you can do this right now. So don't beat yourself up. Just enjoy it.
And also, A, it's your job, and B, just because you find it great doesn't mean that the next person or the person next to you feels the exact same way. A lot of people I work with, a lot of engineers now, and they are struggling with, you know, any kind of literature-related things, literature-related tasks, even more than I would in physics or any kind of engineering related. So just because it's a skill of yours and it's your career path, right? It's all totally justified.
Well said. Yeah, very good framing.
Jesus, thank you. Sam, on that note, tell us, where can people find you? Where can people learn more about you and your work and your van life?
Yeah, well, if people want to know more about my van life, they can follow me on Instagram. I'm sure you'll have my handle. It's Sam's in the Van. Or YouTube, same thing, Sam's in the Van. But if somebody wants to reach out, if they want to work with me, if they want coaching either for grad school or if they have kids, they're doing a homeschooling or a hybrid method who need extra support. Or if you're an early career scholar who wants a book coach, basically because you don't have your dissertation advisor anymore and you want somebody who's, like, lovely but still very organized and kind of strict with you to get things cracking, I love doing that. So my website is just SamanthaMorse.com, and I welcome any consultations or anything like that.
That's amazing. Sam, thank you so much for taking the time and coming on to the show today. You can join the conversation now on our social media and share your experiences with getting published and trying to get published in these big prestigious journals. And Sam and I, of course, will be in the comments. And if there's anything that you have an issue with, you know, drop us a message, drop us a comment, and we'll do our best to get back to you and help you. But anyway, this is a community, the PhD pending community. So everyone's welcome and all the struggles are legit and justified. So just come on up. As per usual, you can find the show on Instagram and Twitter at phdpenningpod, or write us an email at phdpenningpod@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to subscribe and support the show on our Buy Me a Coffee page so we can keep creating content for you. And I will see you again here in 2 weeks. And Sam, thanks again for coming onto the show.
Thank you.
That was amazing. I love this.
Yay. Oh my.
I know, yeah. This episode of PhD Pending was written and produced by me, Anna Mahler. Artwork by Jerome Kelleher. You can find the show on Instagram and Twitter at phdpendingpod or write an email to phdpendingpod@gmail.com. If you enjoy the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and make sure to rate us 5 stars so others can find it too. You can also donate on our Buy Me a Coffee page so we can keep creating content for you. The link is in the show notes.